recess. It was a fun recess. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on H.J.R. 13.
Senator George has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on H.J.R. 13. Any objections to that? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move we reconsider the vote by which H.J.R. 13 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved that we reconsider the vote by which H.J.R. 13 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered.
Mr. Yep. I can read you too. Mr. Chairman, I move we rescind the D-4 amendments on H.J.R. 13.
Senator George has moved that we rescind the -A4 amendments to H.J.R. 13. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Okay, so we have the A5s now in front of us. I don't know, David, do you want to talk? Do you want to say a brief why these A5s are in front of us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Following your passage of H.J.R. 13 yesterday, we discovered a little drafting flaw in the amendment, which would have rescinded the double majority rule for all capital bond elections the way it was written. The dash A5s merely reapply the double majority requirement to all bond elections under this new section 11K of the Constitution. So I'll be happy to answer any questions. I think there is also a dash A6
which, we're just getting
which broadens the list to include cities, counties, and other special districts as well. And it is identical in all aspects except for that.
So do you guys want to add A6s or do you want to wait for conference? I don't care.
Yeah, let's add the A6. So all we need is the A6 then, if we're going to do A6.
A6s are A5s plus A6s?
Either one. Not both.
Not both.
Yeah.
What does the A6 do? It's the city stuff. Have they talked to you?
No, they haven't talked to me.
Okay, well, then let's not do it then.
Have you talked to me? Okay, I was making sure.
You talking to me?
Okay, then let's just do the A5s.
So. Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move the A5 amendments to H.J.R. 13.
Senator Monroe has moved the A5 amendments to H.J.R. 13. Discussion. Objections. So ordered.
And move H.J.R. 13 as amended back to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved the H.J.R. 3 as amended back to the floor.
13.
Gosh, I'm just going to start missing them on. Well, if I try to miss them, I'll actually get them. H.J.R. 13 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections. So ordered. Monroe?
I will be happy to carry it as per before.
Thank you. Okay, let's go back to the bill that we continue to work on, and amendments continue to come to us. And Council, thank you for keeping them coming. We'll open a public hearing on HB, well, it's listed as a work session, so we'll just do a work session on HB 3201. We don't anticipate to move this bill this afternoon. Representative Boone, Representative Krieger, and do the nurserymen want to join them? Or the nurseryman? Good afternoon.
Chair Decker, for the record, and committee members, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative from District 1. And we are here to testify on House Bill 3201 and an amendment that we would like to put in and talk to you a little bit about the concept. And it was actually the concept that's contained in House Bill 3479, which I refer to as the Family Forest and Farm Preservation Act. As you know, there's been a steady loss of private family forest lands and agricultural lands. In the case of forest lands, many times these have to be, in fact, cut to pay for the owed death tax. To give you a little example of how this thing is maybe misunderstood, and how it grows for a forest landowner. If you have a death tax obligation of, let's say, $100,000, that isn't what you end up having to cut to pay for it. You end up having to pay for the death tax of the $100,000, the state income tax, the federal income tax, the severance tax, the forest tax, the property tax, the reforestation, and if you do the work yourself, you will have the right, I guess you say, to work yourself nearly to death in order to provide that work is done. And if you're still lucky, in 45 to 50 year rotation, those trees will be ready to pay the next death tax. So really what you end up having happen is, in order to get the $100,000, you actually have to cut about $300,000 worth of timber in order to meet that family obligation, with nothing coming back to the family but a lot of hard work after having maybe waited for 30, 40, 50 or longer years to get those trees in a position that they can be marketed. And you also may have to cut them at a time when the market isn't ideal, therefore losing potential earnings off of that. If this could be amended into your bill, it would be make it possible for family-owned natural resource lands to be passed generation to generation, and in my mind, promote a stewardship and conservation effort on those lands by private landowners. And it would also provide an opportunity for young people to stay and live and raise their families on farms and forest land here in Oregon. Our commercial fish families often have large value in their boats, gear, ice, storage facilities, and they may have associated business as small markets and small restaurants. And again, this would be a great benefit to them. These are people that are used to working 16 hours a day for months on end with no time off. Only time that they're not working when the fish are available is when they're sleeping. That's it. The rest of the time they're working. It's also interesting to note that large corporations who have similar assets don't pay inheritance tax. So why do we make farmers, ranchers, forest landowners, and commercial fishing families pay a death tax? They have already paid the tax on those lands. As I've said, those lands often are sold to pay the death tax. I think it's inherently wrong that we do this to those people. Most of them had an investment in those lands for 40, 50 years, sometimes two and three generations or longer. And if we want to have lands managed in a very, I think, environmentally sound way, I think that you can look to what's happened in forestry in recent years, the advancements of adaptive management, Oregon's forest practice rules that are continually being updated. I think they are better in the hands of small woodland owners. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker.
For the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32, the Upper Left Coast. And he stole some of my lines on commercial fishing vessels, so what I'll do is I'll just add the only way for a commercial fishing business to pay this tax would be to whack off the stern end of the boat or de-gear it or something like that, which would make the business non-functional. So I'm glad he picked up on that. And then one other thing I would say is a lot of the small woodlands owners are really getting involved in the green or whatever, the environmentally friendly and green building products. And these are specialty. They're kind of like people who grow niche vegetables, you know, the shishi veggies for your shishi restaurants, et cetera, on a small piece. And these small timberland owners are often, and I want to say a lot, 80% of, I have a map on my little wall that shows all the private ownership in forests, and it's huge all over the state. They're in small pieces. And if, as he said, if they're forced to cut their trees to pay their inheritance taxes, they don't have these trees on the ground anymore. And we were really looking for other things to bone up on with this bill, and that we're right in the middle of a global change situation, and these trees provide good air, if you will. So this is a real win-win, and it helps small resource-based businesses keep their business in their family. And another piece of the bill that Representative Clem had put in and would say if he were here is that requires the family to operate the business as that business for five of the next 7 years, so it's not just a fast turnover. So, and I'm not going to touch nurseries. I'm going to let you do nurseries. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. It's fortuitous that you're talking about this today, because last evening our state board gathered and started having our annual retreat. And this topic is always on top of mind. We have growers who fear, you know, that their father or their mother is going to pass away, and what do they then do? And what this bill does, in large measure, and I give the two representatives to my left a lot of credit, that it raises the exemption. It doesn't eliminate the inheritance tax, but it raises the exemption for farm, forest, and fisheries to $7.5 million. Now, why that amount? Well, there's a lot of it's in land holdings, equipment, the actual land, I mean the houses, all those things add up for the estate to be turned over. And what we really want to promote, that we think is a value, is having farms, forests, and fishery operations be passed from one generation to the next. And so I think this is a sensible, it's a reasonable amendment to your bill here, and I would urge your support.
Thank you. Paul, do you want to briefly go up before we go to any questions right off the bat? Senator George, and then we'll do the revenue.
About the tax consequences of state tax, but Paul's probably going to do that.
Paul.
In terms of revenue impact, Mr. Chair?
Just using the House bill as the guide.
On 3479. Mr. Chair, we have looked at House Bill 3479. It's been heard in the House Revenue Committee. Our estimate, really, largely based on some very detailed federal analysis, is that this bill, or if it's amended into 3201, would reduce general fund revenue by about $1 million per biennium, or about $500,000 per year.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to echo what our colleagues have said, and that is I watched, and it broke my heart, it broke my neighbor's heart, to watch a pre-cut on a reprod in which these trees were harvested way before they should have been harvested. You know, today they would be looking towards maturity. But then it was truckloads of little sticks going to a chipper of beautiful Doug fir. So, but, you know, people make decisions based upon tax law and estate, whatever happens to mom and dad, and it can be devastating to the environment. The good news about that piece of property, it did eventually change hands and is now a vineyard. But, you know, those of us who would have loved to have seen this beautiful forest, it now has beautiful little vine grapes going on.
Other questions for the panel?
They're good. Good.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing that. So you're waiting. My understanding is you're waiting for an amendment.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Great.
Have you put it into council yet?
We have. We will.
Okay. Christina, is your amendment ready? As she cheers on the representatives. Anyone else want to talk about that estate tax provision? Okay, Christina McNitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and since I'm just following on the heels of this other discussion, I'll say I'm with the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, and amen to that potential amendment for the inheritance tax. One thing I'd like to get on the record for your consideration is that just in the non-industrial ownership class alone, in Oregon, we're losing between 22 and 26,000 acres a year from a forested land base to other uses. And part of the feedback that we hear from our membership is that that's because of taxes and regulation, and inheritance tax is a big issue. And then on behalf of the cabin owner advocates, I'm in front of you today to talk about the -A4 amendments and hope you might consider them. They are actually a rework of a bill 3293 that we heard in the House Revenue Committee. We had a good hearing. To my knowledge, there's no opposition to the bill. It was just a late hearing in the process, and 3201 might serve as a good vehicle for us to take a hitchhike on. And I also understand the bill has no revenue impact. What the A4 amendments would do is remove the sunset on an existing property tax exemption for leased and permitted cabins that are located on federal lands. And this exemption applies only to the land under the cabins that is actually owned by the U.S. Forest Service and the BLM. This exemption has been continuously extended through repeated sunsets since it was first adopted in 1975. The state hasn't collected this tax in over 32 years. In lieu of paying these property taxes, the reason this sunset or this exemption was even created is because in lieu of paying those taxes, the cabin owners instead pay an annual federal permit fee. And those are calculated on 5% of the appraised value of the permitted lots. And 25% of all of those fees go back to the counties. Attached to my testimony is a spreadsheet that shows figures from 2002 as they relate to the 15 counties in Oregon with cabins on federal land. The permit and lease fees are also annually indexed and typically include substantial increases upon renewal, which usually occur about every 10 years. Additionally, cabin owners also pay an annual property tax to their local counties based on the value of the improvements on that federal lot, which include the cabin, any other buildings, structures, improvements to the land such as water, septic systems, and electricity services. And attached to this testimony is also an example of a local property tax statement. Oregon cabin owners support the permanent exemption of what basically would amount to a double taxation of properties under federal permits and leases. Various individuals, my star witnesses are in their 80s, and they weren't able to come up here today, but they've been involved in extending a sunset ever since the early 70s. And these amendments would propose to actually permanently extend the exemption. And I'd be happy to answer any questions and hope that you consider the A4 amendments.
Great. Thank you. Questions for Ms. McNitt? Senator Monroe.
Well, I get asked a lot about what's changed in the 20 years or so that I've been gone from here. This issue was before us 20 years ago, extending that sunset. The issue of timber taxes 30 years ago, the chair of the House Revenue Committee, Earl Blumenauer, assigned me as vice chair to review timber taxes, and we went from the ad valorem to the tax on the actual cut timber, and we did it so that people wouldn't have to cut timber prematurely, so they wouldn't have to sell land, because prior to that time they were actually taxed not only on the timber land but on the value of the standing timber. A property tax, and instead we went to the current severance tax system, which I would hope is working out reasonably well.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, that isn't actually contained in the -A4 amendments, but to answer your question, it is working out well for timber landowners, and there's even a provision for the non-industrial landowners where they pay 20% on an annual basis and then 80% the balance at the time of harvest, which is when they're generating income.
Yeah.
But the A4 amendments actually deal with the property tax and a situation where without the exemption, there could be a double taxation situation.
I was a poor city boy, I remember, and I learned more about timber taxes than I ever wanted to know.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you, having the cabins on here is good. All these pictures of the cabins, it's good incentive for us to
get out
go
of here
to a
go
summer
vacation.
Go to one of these summer cabins. Other questions for Ms. McNitt on her -A4 amendments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Gail Riddell, you've seen these. You're
whatever you worship.
That you guys have been consulted on. Great.
Chairman, you want to move these as we go along?
Let's move those in.
Okay. I'll move the -A4 amendments to House Bill 3201.
Senator Gary George has moved the -A4 amendments to House Bill 3201 discussion.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Burdick.
I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest because my family has a cabin that I think might be affected by this.
And are they any of these on here?
I was trying to see. Is cabin number 3 in on Metolius?
I don't know. I think it's
What a coincidence that would be if they actually had, or good work, one of the two.
It's not my family cabin, I'll tell you that.
Looks familiar. Is cabin number four open the week of August 7th? Okay, the potential conflict of interest has been noted by Senator Burdick for a discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Now, this completely removes the sunset. It does. So no future legislature will have to deal with this ever again.
I'm just searching why we would want to have us. I mean, when Ms. McNett first talked to me about it in a brief hallway discussion, the only thought I had is removing sunsets is... It is removing a sunset.
I know, and something you usually don't like to do.
I like to keep, but why would you? I mean, I guess the question I ask myself is why we would have a sunset on this program.
You're comfortable with it, so am I.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I could imagine would be that when I force the federal government to give back the property that belongs to us, that 55% of our state, then we will adjust this to make sure the counties are well protected.
Well, we could. You want to put out? I'll give you 5 years to do
five on there. Okay.
To get the federal government to give back our property. Okay. So I'm fine. Any other discussion on the A?
This is over. We'll know that global warming is ended.
On the A4s. Any objections? So ordered. Okay. A4s have been adopted. Let's see, who else has their amendments? Mark Nelson, do you want to come and talk? Is Mark here? About his amendment. We're waiting for the big amendment.
Mark Nelson's amendment.
No, this is his for Ick. Sorry. We're going to see if he's
done. It's the big amendment.
A lot of the package. This is to the Betsy. So whoever's doing the Betsy would be the staff. Okay. We got Mark up here, so we're going to do Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. My name is Mark Nelson, industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. Being handed out to you now is a amendment which we had to House Bill 2211 that we scratched it out to House Bill 3201, and we made the request to have the amendment prepared for this particular bill. What I've done with the graph that I've handed out to try to show you the impact of the current language of what's called Section 5A, and then what the impact of the amendment would be. And on the amendment, I'd ask you to just note on line 5 the two words, energy resources. Very important distinction. And then I'll take you to the graph and show you how, from ICNU's point of view, how this works. This is a hypothetical, and I'm moving you now all the way back to Senate Bill 408, which was a bill passed last session dealing with taxes collected in rates versus actually paid to units of government by the utilities. And this is a hypothetical of 408. Let's just assume that throughout the year, the taxes collected in rates is $120 million. So we've collected from ratepayers $120 million. When the utility goes to pay its taxes, they actually paid only $100 million. Certain things happen in terms of their forecast, and they only paid $100. Under Senate Bill 408, there would be an automatic adjustment clause of $20 million returned to the ratepayers. And that is how Senate Bill 408 works. When we discussed 408, ICNU and The utilities, of course, agreed on very little in the bill, as you remember. But we did agree with the utilities' argument that energy resource tax credits, BETCI tax credits, that were used for energy purposes, a generation of electricity, should be returned back to them as an offset against the automatic adjustment clause. So in this case, rather than $20 million owed, if the if there were $2 million in energy tax credits, they should get a credit of $2 million, and they would only we'd be rebating $18 million instead of $20 through the automatic adjustment clause. Our problem in the language that's there in 5A is it's very, very broad. It's not just limited to energy resources. It includes all BETCI tax credits, including those for recycling and for transportation issues. You heard the discussion of bus passes, those kinds of things. We believe that is unrelated to ratepayers, and that credits purchased from third parties for that purpose should not be applied against the automatic adjustment clause. So your second arrow there, where you have $2 million in non-energy tax credits, this amendment would prevent those tax credits being purchased and being applied back to the automatic adjustment clause to ratepayers who really, it's not directly related to the energy issue of the generation of electricity. I put behind the chart, Mr. Chairman, just an example of how the BETCI tax credit works. You'll see you have a school district or a nonprofit, someone who isn't paying taxes, makes an expenditure that's eligible for a BETCI tax credit. They, of course, won't use it. So, and you've allowed, and statutes allow for the selling of the tax credit. In this particular case, the tax credit is worth $2,875,000,000. The Department of Energy actually sets the sale price by percentage. Right now, it's for a 35% tax credit. It is 25.5%. They believe it's going to be somewhere between 35 and 40%. So I picked 38% here. So that sets the sale price of the credit. So PGE pays X school district $2,185,000 for that tax credit, purchase it from. They then get the full tax credit and the reduction of their taxes. The net to the utility is $690,000. They only paid $2,185,000. And they have their taxes reduced by $2,875,000. The net to the utility is $690,000. And that's spread out over 5 years, and that's what the Department of Energy views as the cost of the money. So it's a good deal for the utilities. It's a good deal for the school district. We're in total agreement with this. But there are other parties out there that purchase these tax credits. We're just saying for utilities, when you allow them to apply it back to the automatic adjustment clause, they are, in fact, reducing the amount of money that would have gone back to ratepayers under Senate Bill 408. We think it's great as it relates to energy resource tax credits. We agree to that. But we don't agree that it should apply to the non-energy resource tax credits. And I know that's all clear as mud, but it gets a little complicated. But it, in effect, works that way.
So, Mark, and I don't want to break your... So, Mark, one of the questions is I've heard, at least from a few of the nonprofit kind of school district world, obviously, and they just are beneficiaries and supportive of some of the good things that have happened through the purchasing of the tax credits. What confidence do you have that there are other entities out there that will pick up the slack if we adopt this and our utilities no longer are the purchasers of the BETCIs for, let's use the Albina Head Start example? That Albina Head Start, who's reached out to me to say how appreciative they are of this program, that someone else would be able to purchase.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as you know, we also represent Head Start. So
I did not mean to pick.
It's a very, very good example, and I don't pretend to be an expert as to the market out there. But my understanding of this is there's a lot of interest, especially as you are now raising it to 50%, and you can see what kind of dollars it generates as a return back to the investor. I believe that, but I can't, again, I don't know the market, and Michael Graney, I think, might be a better expert on that. The numbers work very well, whether it's for a utility or for somebody else. We just don't believe ratepayers should be assuming those costs.
So, and that,
if
that
there is an automatic adjustment clause, I should preface that, because there isn't. We don't know how many times or how often you'll have an automatic adjustment clause.
That would ratchet down the utility rates.
Right.
Other questions, and I'm just going to put out a call for Michael Graney, if you're listening to this. I don't know if he knows that Betsy's being thought of for 3201. But that would be a good answer to have. I'd like to have it of other entities that would be out there available to purchase these for any non-501c3 that's participating. Senator Starr.
I'll try to find that list, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, this was in House Bill 2211, came through the House Revenue Committee, I assume. Did you raise this issue when it was in the House, in the House Revenue Committee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, that's a very good question. We had the same concern in the House side. PGE and ICNU lawyers discussed it at that time. They went back and forth in discussion. From everything I've gathered, talking to both PGE and our people, I think they didn't get to any conclusion. PGE, I think, believes one of our lawyers didn't respond to them in a timely manner. I'm not sure about that, but we got to the point where all of a sudden the bill was going to move, and we said we'll try to fix it in the House. In the House, we've had extended discussions, again, ICNU, with Michael Graney, and looking at the intent of the language, and we thought we'd reached an agreement that we would read some intent into it, and I don't think in the end Michael was felt comfortable with that, and Wednesday of last week we were asked again an amendment. So we have been slow.
So, Mr. Chair, so it was the issue was not raised in front of the committee, that you were behind the scenes conversations.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that's correct.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Moreau.
I have a letter here from Randy Tucker. He expresses serious concerns about this proposed amendment. He could not be with us today, so I would suggest if we're going to move on this, that we allow input from a number of individuals, some of whom are in this room, that have expressed concern about this change.
Yeah. No, we're the amendment that's before us is actually not to this bill. I believe Mark's waiting for the amendment, and it is word for word, is my understanding.
I just want to make sure that everybody that has an interest in it has an opportunity to
absolutely
talk to us.
And the question that for Randy would be the same question that I was going to ask Mike Graney. Other entities that would say we did make this change, and a utility is no longer purchasing those tax credits. I've got it.
Oh, okay.
Are there other entities out there that would be just as interested, so the program that Randy's had success with would continue? Other questions for Mr. Nelson? Thank you very much. Utilities, would you like to weigh in now, or you do? They're ready. And anyone else, just flag us that if you want to weigh in on this. I assume you've received the language for the amendment.
Yeah.
You want to, Jeff? Okay, come on up. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Deckert, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Probably here, it's pretty frustrating for us, because if you adopt this amendment, you're basically telling us to no longer go forward with energy efficiency measures. For Northwest Natural, we don't generate electricity. We sell a commodity, it's natural gas. So when we're going out and looking for energy efficiency, we're looking to do that with our customers. So we're basically using the pass-through mechanism. And we have very little opportunity for a direct investment. So it primarily is with customers. So if you adopt it, we'll take the same stance that we did probably after adoption of Senate Bill 408, which is we stopped working with customers. It's frustrating for us because some of the organizations that are proposing this amendment, we have a number of their members who are coming to us today asking us to work with them. We've used these credits for mills. We use them for hospitals. We use them with various governmental entities, school districts, Washington County. We've used them with demonstration projects to determine whether or not certain technology will actually work going forward. We've used them for things that I think has been expressed maybe people don't want us to use them for. We've used them with the city of Salem with their buses. We've used them with the Port of Portland and their buses in order to reduce the air quality impact that they're having. For example, the around the airport, the port was being directed to find ways to reduce the air quality impact they were having. One way to do that is to convert buses to compressed natural gas. In addition, you have to then do a whole infrastructure that goes along with that. So we've worked with that. We've worked with folks even doing forklifts so that the air quality within warehouses is better. So again, the way we use the tax credits is to actually work directly with the customer in support of their activities to better their operations. And so we're not using it for generating electricity. And if that's what you want to focus it on, then we're pretty much out of the business. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Questions for Northwest Natural?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Scott Bolton with PacifiCorp. Really three comments regarding this amendment that has been brought to you, first towards 2211, now to 3201. First is process. I appreciate Senator Starr's question because the language in 5A, kind of going back to when I had an opportunity to speak about this, I think it was Monday, the reason Department of Energy included that language in House Bill 2211 was to clarify that the incentive for investor-owned utilities to participate in the Business Energy Tax Credit program that existed pre-Senate Bill 408 remained post-Senate Bill 408. The legislature went past Senate Bill 408, did speak to the Business Energy Tax Credit itself. As Mr. Nelson alluded to, there was wide agreement, I think, that that incentive should be retained at the very least for direct investment by utilities that generate that tax credit. And in the PUC's adoption of rules implementing Senate Bill 408, there is an acknowledgement that that participation in that program should be preserved, and it is a an add back, if you will, as far as the utilities the utilities explanation of its taxes that are paid to government to fulfill the mandate of Senate Bill 408. So there is a long history that is a benefit for both the utility shareholder and the consumer and should be protected. The question that brought the 5A language in 2211 was, is there some risk or is there uncertainty around utilities participation as a pass-through partner under the Betsy program? And there was some disagreement over how far that extended. That's why that language exists today and has been debated and passed unanimously through House Policy Committee and a Senate Policy Committee on this. So it has been raised as an issue, at least among the Department of Energy and committee members, to affirm that, yes, it is the public policy of State of Oregon to allow that pass-through partnership opportunity without limitations. So we are a little bit perplexed and frustrated that this issue has risen up now at this late stage of the process. The second comment that I have is really to the amendment itself, which I believe is somewhat, I understand the intent driving the amendment, but I think is somewhat contradictory to the testimony that you've heard. In line 5, where it says that tax credits should be used pursuant to the section for conservation of renewable energy resources, and that really is the entirety of the Betsy program as far as we see it. Issues or activities such as recycling or alternative fuel sources or transportation programs, those are conservation, in our mind at least, and that's how it's been before Senate Bill 408 and continues to be in a lot of folks' minds since, including those pass-through partners that have provided letters to the committee that have benefited from our participation in the program. And I also want to direct the committee to the end of line 5 and line 6, which I think settles the issue in my mind as far as who bears the cost of the program. ICNU's amendment says that provided that ratepayers do not bear any costs associated with acquiring the tax credit. That's true. Our companies, when we acquire the Betsy from a pass-through partner or through direct investment, are using shareholder dollars to do that. These are not ratepayer dollars. The example that Mr. Nelson provides is exactly as he described it. It's a hypothetical. It's a theoretical that does not have all of the inputs into how 408 would work and adjustments under the automatic adjustment clause based on what happened with the utility's revenue in a given year. These clauses could go up, they could go down, but I think the fundamental policy idea behind the authors of Senate Bill 408 that the Betsy program should be preserved for IOU investor-owned utility participation should be preserved. So, again, I think the amendment itself acknowledges that ratepayers do not bear the cost of this program. And then, really, finally, and I'll turn this over to Portland General, I want to emphatically inform the committee that 100% of those pass-through partners that my company engages with in this program are our customers. They are the Central Oregon Council on Aging, who we help for three counties with their senior and disabled services to move seniors in the region to medical facilities and to senior centers and to different activities. It is Metro trying to cut down on transportation costs and congestion in the Portland metropolitan area. It's the City of Lebanon, who we've worked with their transportation program. These fulfill the mandate of the Betsy credit by conserving energy, but they're also our customers, and these are the needs of our customers. So if the committee's concern is that ratepayers are disadvantaged or somehow harmed by a utility's participation in the Betsy program, I just want to make it very clear that while one group of customers wants to limit our participation, it's with other customers. Our customers, at the end of the day, are the beneficiaries of our pass-through partnerships. And again, you know, different customers have different needs. Some need direct investment, renewable energy, and conservation in their plants. Others need help with basic services. Thank you.
Senator Church.
Just really quickly, if you don't get the utility tax reduction by purchasing these and utilizing them, can't you legitimately come back and say, because of the high level of taxation that I paid, that I can roll that to the consumer, to the ratepayer, if you weren't able to take the reduction in taxes?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's exactly correct. In Mr. Nelson's example, he's presuming a downward rate adjustment due to the utility underperforming and paying less in taxes than was...
You're referring to this example.
Yes, than was predicted in a rate case. However, there's no way that $120 million assumed in that example will ever occur. It will either be more or less. And in that example of where the utility undercollects taxes because it has performed better than was expected in the last rate case, by participating in the Betsy program, that will lower the overall tax burden for the utility and its consumers. So it's a customer benefit when it goes that way.
And Scott, you kind of got at this, but... How would you, I guess the core of the argument that Mr. Nelson makes is that these are good, they're important, but they're not energy generation. They are other ancillary benefits to all of us as a community, but ought not be included in the Betsy program for utilities. How would, you got at it, but how would you directly respond to they're good, but they're not energy generation to the direct benefit of customers?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I think how I would answer that question, at least on Pacific Power's behalf, is that these are a customer partnership when we enter into the Betsy program. Some customers may be more energy intensive, such as ICNEW's members, where investment in an on-site cogeneration project that produces Betsy's may be more beneficial and therefore, in their mind, more closer to our business practice or our business mission. But again, we don't view it necessarily as just because it's related to electricity, that's why we're participating. We're participating because this is a program where we can help our customers. Just as the Central Oregon Council on Aging, we can help that customer through the use of the Betsy program, even though it may be a transportation need or helping weatherize a senior facility. So, again, I'm not sure that I agree with the assumption or construct that we should only be using the Betsy for electricity-related issues. Every taxpayer, every business in Oregon that qualifies for the Betsy as a pass-through partner doesn't have that same constraint, and I think to use Senate Bill 408 as the rationale for placing a new restraint on investor-owned utilities is a stretch and is a new argument. It's certainly not something that was contemplated when the bill was passed last session.
Gary. Mr. Chair, Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural. Let me try another answer to that, too. For example, if we use it with combined heat and power projects where you basically are able to take the waste heat and use that as well, yes, that's a benefit to that customer. But any time we can lower the overall demand for natural gas, we believe we'll have an overall price benefit when you collect all of those together for our customers. And so, again, part of our effort is to keep the demand from natural gas from growing as much as it has been and thus lower the price impact.
Thank you. Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Gallagher for Portland General. I'm not going to repeat the excellent way which my colleagues here describe what the utilities do with the money and why we should go beyond conservation renewables. Just let me focus on line six, where the language says not bear any of the costs, and venture into the thicket of the double whammy in 408. What I think the cost here that IGNU is talking about is the situation where the utility collected rates at $10 million a year in taxes, but they only paid $5 million a year. So there's a $5 million refund going to customers under the automatic adjustment clause. If we took a tax credit on that $5 million, we would reduce that a little bit. It would come down to the value of the Betsy tax credits we bought. So let's say it comes down $100,000. That's $100,000 less that would go back in the automatic adjustment clause. And that's what we're talking about, and I think that's what we're asking the committee to weigh. What's the value of us buying those tax credits, getting those conservation and renewable values versus that tiny small amount of money in my example, and another example might be larger, that might not get returned to all the customers in the automatic adjustment clause. So that's what we're fighting over.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Jeff, before we go to you, can we get the Mike Graney answer? Mike, you probably weren't tracking 3201. You are now. Senator Monroe, do you want to pose the question? I'll pose it. So we've heard from many of the beneficiaries of these pass-through credits that our IOU utilities just spoke to, who have at least let me know, and I think other members of the committee, that they're concerned that they've been beneficiaries of the program, and it's helped on several fronts. The question that I had was, are there other entities out there, say the IGNU amendment was included in the bill, and that Gary Bauer's Northwest Natural example just went forward, that they would just no longer participate at all? Mm-hmm. Are there other entities out there that would purchase these tax credits so the metros of the world would continue to do their program?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. There have been other pass-through partners that have participated, but the investor-owned utilities are important ones, and they're some of the larger companies in terms of their ability to acquire tax credits and use them. So they were very important players, and after Senate Bill 408 passed, the three largest investor-owned utilities that you just heard from stopped while they evaluated the tax implications of that law in terms of their ability to participate. And they have not been participating since that time.
They have not?
No. And that has been... So they stopped even before we had the problem with Senate Bill 819 and the kicker issue. And that reduced the number of companies that we could pair schools and nonprofit organizations up with.
And who instigates these pass-throughs? Is it the Department of Energy that instigates a kind of a loaded word? Who brings the partners together?
We can do that, and we offer to do that. Individual taxpayers can do that themselves. Some, for example, have a relationship with a bank that they'll do that with. or another company. The law allows it either way.
Mm-hmm. But one of the first persons or entities that y'all might contact mm-hmm. would be one of our IOU utilities.
Yes, very definitely, as well as some of the larger banks have been very active as well.
Mm-hmm. Questions for Mr. Graney?
Well, Mr. Chair, and this program then becomes very valuable to nonprofits because there's a market for their credits that are of no value to them since they're not a taxpaying entity.
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's allowed many schools, hospitals, and other nonprofit entities, and also businesses that don't have tax liability. And we have that with a number of the renewable energy companies that are startup companies have in their initial years not a lot of revenue, so not a lot of tax liability. So that is a key factor in terms of that tax credit.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Yeah, we worked so hard on 819 to get it through dealing with really the same kind of issue, making those credits valuable once again. I'd hate to see us mess them up.
Senator George.
Well, I'm about to ask a question I know the answer to, but could I do it anyway?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
All right, thank you. The question is this. I'm looking at the Metro piece that we have right here, and they're talking about these cash payments and the cash payment again. And they're talking about they have something they can't use, which is the credit. But they did do what we asked them to do by going to energy-saving vehicles or whatever
yes.
programs. All right, with the cash payment, they multiply the savings on the energy efficiency that we're asking them to do because now they have more money to do the same thing. I don't see this going to be a burden upon the ratepayer. I just can't see that, and maybe it's just my mind. And so I'm trying to think where the loser is here. We accomplished the social goal that we wanted and provided cash, and at the same time we allowed somebody to avoid some taxation, which did not come from the ratepayer. So is there anyone that ends up being negatively impacted?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, I agree with your analysis. I think you're correct. And I think that the ICNU amendment tries to make a distinction between different energy savings measures that's really not valid. Transportation measures, for example, that qualify for the tax credit, whether the transit passes, van pooling expenses, those all save energy. We document the energy savings. And in fact, it's probably the most important sector because it directly reduces the consumption of oil. And that affects utility prices, both natural gas prices for the natural gas utilities and natural gas that the electric utilities use to generate electricity. So there's a direct relationship there. Recycling, which was another area of concern for ICNU, is a huge energy savings, both in terms of raw materials that are reused and in terms of finished products. So there's direct energy savings there, too, which is why the policy decision the legislature made some years ago to include those projects in as eligible for the business tax credit, that it's not just a hardware equipment in buildings, commercial lighting or heating or industrial processes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Bissonnette, and then Mark, if you care to, you can respond to that. If you would like not to, that's fine too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette representing the Citizens Utility Board, representing residential ratepayers of utilities, and I'll try and be extremely brief. Just 3 points to make. One is we haven't shared the industrial customers' concerns over the interplay. I've inquired many times for our regulatory people who've been dealing with the implementation of 408, Senate Bill 408 over in at the PUC. And they're fine on the language that's been in Senate Bill 2211, and so we've been supportive of that. Secondly, I think it was alluded to in response to a question from Senator George. The automatic adjustment clause does work sort of as a two-way street. There may be times when there more taxes have been collected than paid, in which case consumers get money back. There also, again, might be times when there's an under-collection in which there's, and then there'll be a surcharge. And so in which case, a tax credit would actually help, reduce the surcharge. The other part that ICNU points out is that we get a little less money back. But that's okay to get to the transition to the third point, and I guess responding to a question from either or both Senator George, Senator Monroe, reducing energy does, sort of at the end of the day, any sort of energy, is reduces somebody's footprint. And in the case of utilities, let me tell you, they have several of them have big carbon footprints to try and reduce. And so anything that they can do, whether it's through their own operations and reducing utility energy consumption, is great. And we have programs to do that and make a lot of investment in that, and we'll continue to support that. But also, if they can help either their customers, whether residential, commercial, or industrial, or help other nonprofits and that sort of thing, reduce energy, help other governmental agencies reduce energy, that helps us all in the long term and something that we're very supportive of.
Thank you.
Quick one? Oh, please. All right. I'm the utility. Federal government says reduce your carbon footprint. And I say, okay, I have a bunch of ways I can do it. I start now my process. But one of the things I say is, well, okay, can I get someone else to go out and do that, reduce the footprint? Then I buy those credits, use those credits towards getting my numbers down. Is that a legitimate thought? Because you're hearing that these things are coming. To me, that would mean you would especially want to preserve this program, which would have already established those relationships and concepts of how to achieve the social goal of reduction, but at the same time making sure that everybody could adjust to what the new reality of the requirements are.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it's a little bit apples and oranges, but it's heading in the same direction. If there's a requirement, say, for an emissions performance standard for a utility to reduce its emissions, then the utility's got to reduce its emissions. However, if there is another sort of carbon regulation regime, like sort of a cap-and-trade system that's economy-wide, then we're looking for all kinds of ways, certainly through utilities because they are a big producer of carbon emissions, but we're also looking to reduce carbon emissions through, transportation means, which is the other big driver of carbon emissions and that sort of thing. And where we have the ability for all players, including utilities, to help not only in their own backyard but in sort of the yard next to them, definitely helps. And so, again, if we're looking, if there's a response directly to or a requirement directly to a utility, mm-hmm. we want them to do that and make those investments, and that's great. If there's an economy-wide, we want sort of all hands on deck, and this is definitely a useful tool in helping that to happen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to the eggs. Do you want to talk about the egg, the A5s, the egg processing facilities, and if Representative Gilliam, who sent me the note, if he's free to join you. He's waiting to know. His office is waiting. His amendment is up.
Okay. Do you want to wait for him to be present?
No, I don't. If he wanted to be here.
I think he was okay without that. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's John Ramig. I'm with the Hagen O'Connell firm. We represent Willamette Egg Farms. And let me say at the outset that in response to a suggestion from the chair, we're in the process of reworking the A5 amendment to provide a local option, which recognizes that the exemption is supported by counties where the majority of the facilities are in, but the counties association had expressed some concern about the bill, and so this is an attempt to bridge that difference. So in concept, what the bill does is provide a property tax exemption for investment in new egg processing equipment, which is the value-added segment of eggs. And it was originally proposed in House Bill 3548, which provided an exemption for both egg processing and dairy processing. The dairy processing portion of the bill had a significant revenue impact. So the reason we're here today is the bill has been reworked to address eggs only, eliminate that impact, and then with local option, presumably eliminate any opposition to the bill. It was originally crafted with the support of Representative Comp, who has a number of workers in the district where egg processing facilities are, Representative Boone, Representative Hunt, Representative Gilliam, who's been mentioned before. The basic premise behind the bill is it provides an incentive for egg processors who are already substantial providers of family wage jobs to expand their operations into a high-value segment, which not only provides additional jobs, but diversifies their business and provides more stability for not only the jobs that are already there, but new jobs. So it's essentially, from a policy standpoint, an economic promotion bill. And I wanted to provide that background and indicate that we will be coming back with a A5 amendment crafted for a local option.
And I could ask Mary this too. Mary, you want to hit the fiscal on the...
The fiscal for this particular dash five amendment is roughly $7,000 for 08-09. For the biennium, 07-09 is roughly $15,143. And for 09-11, about $16,000. And that was based on an estimate of about $300,000 a year in machinery and equipment assessed value. And the tax on that would be what I've mentioned for you.
The only other comment I'd add, Chair Deckard and members of the committee, is that your suggestion there on the retooled amendment, there'll be a four-year sunset.
Four-year sunset. Okay.
Great. Gail? Those are lower. Gail, do you want to come up and join our representative?
You may not want to sit next to me.
We're old friends.
Are you really? That's great.
Mr. Chair, do you want my comments on this?
Yeah, and do you, you know, I came up with the local option in the hall. Is that if the fiscal's this low?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I need to provide some background on this particular program for you to be well aware of what you're doing. This is not a garden variety property tax exemption program. It has a specific narrow focus, and this would change the character of the program and open it unquestionably to other concerns. In 2005, the counties, ALC, were the only local taxing districts, only local governments to support this program, and we stood at the signing ceremony proudly. The other local governments did not, and I think this is beginning to look like no good deeds go unpunished. This program started from an idea of the Northwest Food Processors Association. They came to ALC early on, and to the Department of Agriculture and Department of Revenue and other stakeholders. They presented what we considered an ironclad case that there were certain processors that were on the brink of going under. There was clear. However, worked with them. We got the program narrowed and precise. We got to the point where they presented 16 plant closures in 5 years, significant reductions in assessed value, and our assessors confirmed that. So we worked very hard to have this razor sharp focus, and we had the agreement of the Northwest Food Processors Association. The revenue impacts and implications were minimized. This particular proposal is not at all the same. This is a proposal for a company that we're glad to see is doing very well. They want some local investment through this property tax exemption to do even better, and that's fine. But this is a program that had specific designation, and this does not fit that program. So you need to know that.
Question?
Yeah, Senator Monroe.
What was the nature of the food processing companies that were saved by the legislation that was passed that you approved?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, It's specifically defined as a business of freezing, canning, dehydrating, concentrating, preserving, processing, repackaging for human consumption raw or fresh fruit, vegetables, nuts, legumes, or seafood. That was the most target. They were the most endangered food processors.
Okay. Additional question. So egg processing equipment would be dissimilar from that kind of a...
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, the condition of the egg processing portion of the sector is different. Now, this program was not designed to treat every food processor of every kind. We worked with the association to make sure it was targeted to those that needed immediate help. We had a program specifically designed for them, and it sunsetted.
Additional question. If we granted this amendment for egg processing equipment, do you see this opening the, quote, slippery slope, camel's nose under the tent, Pandora's box, use your own metaphor, for other groups to come in and ask for similar treatment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I don't think there's any question that you will not be approached by the dairy folks, by the bread folks, by all the rest of them. No, I don't think there's any question about that. They went to the House committee this session, and they presented their effort to get into this, the group that was left out before, and the House committee did not act. But they'll be back.
Okay. Thank you. I'm finished.
Senator Stark, do you have a question? You're okay?
Yeah.
And we will be at ease as we wait for the chair to return.
I don't have any more questions.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator George.
The discussion that Gil just gave us relative to what the real purpose of this was, I agree with. I remember that.
Mm-hmm, I do.
You do remember it also. Okay.
I think, yeah.
What are you concerned about?
Okay, so perhaps, Gil, thank you, and thank you. And perhaps what I'll do, Senator Monroe and Senator George, I'll ask you, if you would, to meet with the advocate and represent Gilliam and decide if this is something we can accommodate in this bill or not. So these are this side of the dais is your point people on, with Representative Gilliam on whether this, if it's worthwhile going back to council or not.
Okay, we've already gone to council, but I understand.
They're pretty good about listening, but we'll make sure, and we're going to recess here in a second for about a half an hour. So
we'll go do that.
Okay, so they'll get on that. Okay, I think we've got every amendment that is in front of us. I think we have now. Paul nods at me. Now we have heard. So we are waiting for a large amendment that would have things. Much of the governor's package would be in this large amendment, and other tax credits. It's the core amendment, and we're waiting for it, and it should be here. And we'll place it out on. I would on that table as soon as we get it, and we'll recess till 3:30. And then what I'd like to do at 3:30, committee, is just walk through that amendment so that we've got at least the table of what's in the core amendment, and take any testimony that we might need to take on the core amendment to 3201.
Doesn't our Ways and Means Sub meet at 3:30?
Yeah, so I'm going to recess them. Okay, so we will stand in recess. We should have an amendment in 15 minutes, is what I'm told. So we'll recess until...
3:15?
Well, let's recess until 3:30.
But aren't there Ways and Means Committee's meeting, too?
There's a number. And Senator Starr and I are going to go down and meet for 20 minutes, is what Devlin wanted us to do. So we'll meet with...
leave our stuff here.
Yeah, leave all our stuff. Well, why don't we come back here at 3:25 just to work through the core amendment?
Okay.
We'll stand in recess till 3:25.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Have the amendment, and we'll not have the amendment, I don't think, Paul, for a couple hours now.
I think that's true, Mr. Chair. In the editing process, we have basically asked council to combine a number of bills relating to taxation, but there's some couple of the bills have some other elements to them that don't meet the relating to clause. So the credit or taxation piece is not a problem, but these other elements have to be stripped out of those bills, and therefore you could consider those individually without the credit in them. So that'll just take a while to do.
Okay, so here's what we'll do, and I'm going to aim for Monday morning to do this, but I just need to check and make sure that we don't need to either stay here tonight or what I'd like to do, because this issue is both in the film and video one and the diesel emissions one, is this particular problem that council, I guess, just found, is we have a number of amendments to this bill. So what we'll do when we start in on Monday is just, we'll obviously go through that core amendment. So that will be the first one with kind of the core elements of 3201. And then we'll look at, three or four that I know of, maybe five dash amendments, one or two we've heard, and then three or four additional ones. So, Paul, what I'd ask is if we could just get since this will buy us, if we do wait till Monday, that buys us 48 hours, so if we could just get a clear chart of the dash sixes, what they do, who proposed them, and just the fiscal or the revenue impact on them, dash sevens, dash eights. Hopefully this buys us a lot of time, so we'll have a lot of clarity when we come back here Monday. And
Mr. Chair,
if I can just finish the sentence or I'll forget it. So so then what we'll do is I would just think we'll just only do this bill on Monday. We won't post anything else, and we'll just roll forward on it. Where if we need to amend things, we'll ask council to make a quick amendment. Hopefully we would get it out sometime on Monday. Senator Monroe.
If there's an interest in the ag amendment, the Department of Revenue would like to have an opportunity to speak on it, too.
Okay.
Are they here? John's back.
Senator Starr and I were both comfortable, at least with the numbers in the ag amendment, or the ag processing amendment. Those seemed like relatively low numbers, was just the one thing that, as we walked down to the other subcommittee.
Well, there seems to be disagreement about whether or not there's full support from the Clackamas County Commission or not. We're getting conflicting reports on that, and so okay. By Monday I'm sure we'll hear from them.
Okay, so I'll leave that up to Representative Gilliam, Senator Monroe, and Department. You're welcome to say something right now if you want to get it done with. We thought we would have a big amendment in front of us, and we got nothing but eggs.
As long as it's not on our face.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Oregon Department of Revenue. We took a look at this when it came out on the House side in the other bill, and we were not aware of the dash fives coming forward today, so I apologize for not being more prepared on that. But there are a lot of issues that we saw in the version in the House that distinguish between primary processing and secondary processing and production line type things. So we worked quite a bit last session on hammering out the differences between the primary and the secondary processing. That was the distinction. That is the distinction the Ag Department looks for when their inspectors are out there. We will probably end up writing rules, and I'm not sure whether the amendment, which I have not seen, actually delineates what's in there. The gentleman testified that they eliminated all the opposition with the discussion about the local option, but they have not talked to us, and I don't know what the language of the amendment is, so I can't comment on the, you know.
Well, in fairness, the local option was my idea walking in here, okay. So I wouldn't put that on them. And the A5s are available.
Okay.
And we'll get you a copy, John. Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, great discussion out there, and I believe that Senator Monroe has briefed you a little bit. The concern that we have, those of us who remember the discussion and the reason for it, the very narrow focus, is that at that 307.455 being affected in a way that it would, in fact, open up the door for things that were never intended by the original legislation. What I asked the representative of the aid processors was, find something else to attach it to rather than 307. So they're going to try to do that. They will provide the local option. And with that, I think there's still opposition to the bill. But just kind of.
John, and Representative Gilliam, if you want to anything, I'd give you that opportunity or... okay. John.
Mr. Chair, and maybe one last comment. There is an exemption already in the statutes that we would have to draw a distinction between in Chapter 307 and 397 that exempts the real and personal property of egg processors already. And there may be a jump from that to another level of machinery and equipment that would then be exempt, and maybe that's the secondary processing part. So that's something we'd have to look at. In last session's bill specifically did exempt specific kinds of processing, like, for example, wineries were specifically excluded last session in that processing bill, but as were eggs.
Okay. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, we need to put this to rest quick because the jokes are already starting, and we came to the conclusion we were not that excited about moving forward with it. And I just have to bring it up because that was coming, and they were looking for an exception. And so
exception,
and I didn't know if we could do that. But I do need to ask a question before we close, and they probably turned off their TVs and computers right now. are each one of these going to be in a separate amendment of the proposals, or are they going to be grouped?
We'll have to see what John. I think were any other questions for John Phillips. My hope is, before you got here, I don't think we're going to do this tomorrow, but I'll go back and double check. But I think Monday would give us enough time with council to get one core amendment, which I believe will contain Betsy, Retsy, Diesel, film and video. I believe something on affordable housing and the personal exemption. So that would be in one amendment, I believe. And the veterans.
And the veterans. So we're preserving the original intent of the bill to a certain extent.
I don't know if Colonel Caldwell, he's here and excited to hear that. We're not taking out any of his, we're adding a lot, but not taking anything. It's not a gut and stuff, no. Yeah. And then you'll see, I believe you'll see four other separate dash amendments, hopefully ready to go, very clear on Monday. And we'll just work through the bill in work session till we get it where we like it. And we're not looking for more amendments at this point to the bill.
You mentioned tomorrow. Are we coming back here tomorrow?
I'm resisting it. I've had three members ask me to not do it. So you seem fine with it.
Well, I've got to be back here anyway. So
anyway.
Gary and I are both on the same news and means side. Right. So we'll be here.
But we'll post within the next. We got to talk to council and see how quickly, because we, frankly, we're just waiting for a big amendment that never materialized today at 3. Anything else before we adjourn for the day? Thank you. We stand adjourned.